As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to Straight Outta Cobham. Now, I know what you're thinking. Those aren't the dulcet tones of Matt Davis Adams. And you'd be bloody right. This is Liam Toomey, obviously, and I am standing in for Matt as host this week. There hasn't been a dressing room fallout, I can assure you of that. He will be back soon, but he's not available today. And the other main drawback of me hosting, slash benefit, depending on your point of view, is that I can't tee myself up for a corny one-liner. But what I can do is introduce Simon Johnson, who's joining us from a hotel utility room in Abu Dhabi. How are you doing, Simon?
Yeah, greetings, everyone, from this luxurious penthouse suite that's in my dreams. Yes, I'm out here in Abu Dhabi. It's great to speak to you, Liam. It's great to speak to a familiar voice. And thank you for your patience before we start recording, because I went on a rant about my delightful trip so far.
No, it's fine. I mean, it's kind of intimidating, you know, trying to helm the ship without Matt. It does feel a bit like
really
Chelsea. It does feel a bit like Chelsea trying to win the Club World Cup without Thomas Tuchel. But we'll do our best.
So are you Zolt Low or Honor Michels?
We'll let the listeners decide. Reply in the comments. That could be dangerous. But we're going to do our best to wrap up the Al Hilal game. Chelsea making it through to their second Club World Cup final, a chance to tick off the one trophy that they haven't won in the Roman Abramovich era and become world champs, and also answer a few of your questions. But first of all, Simon, you were at the game. That's the whole point of you being out there. You were at the game for us.
Is it? What?
I want
to
this
top up my tan.
I want this answer to be dripping in colour. What was the atmosphere like being at the stadium? What did you make of Chelsea's performance?
First and foremost, the atmosphere was quite interesting. I spoke to a few Chelsea fans, as in local Chelsea fans, before I went in. And one of them was like, oh, we'll outnumber Al Hilal. We're massive here, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, wow, amazing. He goes, you'll see when you get inside. Well, I could barely hear the Chelsea fans throughout the entire game. Maybe there was obviously Al Hilal, Saudi Arabia, they didn't have quite as far to travel and they certainly were up for it. I think you probably also had locals that were sort of cheering on the underdog. So it actually made for a really good atmosphere. It was about, I think when the game started, it looked about half empty. And so you're going, oh, this is, you know, a bit underwhelming, but the seats sort of increasingly filled up. There's a attendance of 19,000, but it felt like more than that. And I think that made it feel like quite an away game for Chelsea. You occasionally heard like the pocket of Chelsea fans, I think the English-based ones who've made the trip, you could hear some Chelsea, you know, sort of coming out. And they were instantly sort of hushed or sort of like over, that everyone else responded to them and drowned them out with their own noise. So I found the atmosphere great. And I think Al Hilal, their performance, particularly when they really pushed in sort of in the last stage of the second half, it made for a good, it felt like a cup tie. as for Chelsea's performance, I tweeted, I went, it's like Plymouth all over again. I mean, okay, Al Hilal didn't score, but there were quite a lot of shaky moments. And Chelsea, they could have, it's not even just Plymouth again, it's just Chelsea in general. They could have scored more when they were on top. They didn't. The opposition's get encouragement because of that. They're still in it. And Chelsea end up having to thank Kepa yet again for getting them through a cup game.
Yeah, I tweeted at full time, and I love quoting myself. Is there such a thing as an alarming win? Because I think I just saw one. Chelsea were about as poor as they could possibly get away with being there. And I had some responses from people saying, well, that's maybe a bit harsh. They were actually quite good in the first half, as they often are under Tuchel. They seem to start with quite good energy in games. And then it kind of fades away when they don't take enough chances to properly kill the game. The other team just comes back into it. And it almost felt, I don't know if you felt this, Simon, but it almost felt to me like after about 60 minutes, they were physically flagging. And they'd had this long break, this long lead up to the Plymouth game, or at least long, you know, relative to what they've been through since November with this schedule. Al Hilal played 2 days ago, or 2 days before this game, and it felt like they were kind of fresh as daisies and coming on really strong and pressing Chelsea into mistakes. Sometimes Chelsea were just making mistakes, and Chelsea just, their intensity just fell off a cliff. That was my thoughts anyway. What did you think?
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, it was quite interesting that, so I don't think I'm risking a massive embargo break here. A few of us went and spoke to Marcus Alonso today, and I started off by just going, oh, you know, how have you guys been, you know, since the break, winter break, you know, you've had a couple of tough games. And Marcus did sort of say, look, you know, the break was good, but it's funny how just, even though it was only essentially just a week off because they had to return to training after the first week. But he said, it's funny how that little break is enough to just throw you off your rhythm a little bit and sort of almost have to start all over again. And you can safely say we've been left, you know, journalists, fans, would have been left with that impression off the last two games because, I mean, Plymouth sort of finished the stronger and Chelsea ended up sort of needing Kepa to save that penalty. And, you know, the two saves that Kepa made late in the second half against Al Hilal was very same. Also, I don't know about what you thought, Liam, but the substitution at half-time and then N'Golo coming on, and then N'Golo, we don't know what's up with him at the moment, but it's like there's an imposter there. He's not himself. He doesn't seem to have the energy. He's passing, he's off. And I just thought that coincided with Chelsea losing their grip of the game too. But I'm sure we'll get on to Lukaku in a minute. But I thought Lukaku, conversely, actually got stronger after he scored.
Yeah, I didn't agree with what some people were saying, that he just didn't look interested for 90 plus minutes. I thought he had moments of clear frustration with teammates, which has been a recurring theme, well, basically since he came into the team. But he did keep trying things. He did keep making runs and trying to put himself in positions. It just seemed like he's still nowhere near on the same wavelength as most of these guys. I mean, he had a couple of potential link-ups with Ziyech. I know they're quite good friends, aren't they? And I think that, you know, maybe that's the most promising connection among Chelsea's forwards if they're ever going to unlock Lukaku. But it doesn't feel like it's the level of slickness with any of Chelsea's forwards that it needs to be, especially when you look at what Al Hilal did. You know, they've got a good coach in Leonardo Jardim, who I think a lot of people were surprised to find his coaching in Saudi Arabia, given he was coaching, you know, a Monaco team that reached a Champions League semi-final only a few years ago. And of course, they've got some high-profile players that played at high level in Europe, Odi Ighalo, Musa McGregor, Andre Carrillo. But some of the combinations they were putting together, like little first-time passes around the corner, little give-and-goes, and it just kind of hammers home how stilted it still is in Chelsea's attack by comparison. When you look at the level of talent, I mean, I remember there was a moment in the FA Cup game where there was a little give and go, wasn't there, between Mount and Ziyech, where Ziyech sort of flicked the ball back around the corner. Mount fired it low across the box and Lukaku just missed it. And that felt, you know, promising, but also quite jarring. It was like, this is what should be happening a lot more often. How quick and fast these combinations are. And it was also happening against a vastly inferior opposition in the domestic cup rather than, I don't think we've seen too much of that at all really in Premier League games. It all seems very systematic and quite rigid and unnatural still, or at least to me. And that doesn't seem to be helping Lukaku either.
It doesn't look like they're enjoying themselves. You know, that sort of love of the game, that kind of, oh, we're out here having a great fun. You sort of don't see enough of that. Even when Lukaku scored, it wasn't like he went, love the moment. Okay, look, most of us could have scored that. I think I might have fancied my chances even at my age. But it was a significant moment for him, you know, given he's only scored, he's gone six games without a goal. His only other goal since that interview was against Chesterfield. But it proved to be the winning goal. He gave Havertz a hug and it seemed to be like a thank you, because Havertz, it sort of inadvertently came from his cross, although it took an Al-Hilal defender to have a hellish touch. But but then there were other moments where, like, even for that goal, there was a pass that Kovacic played. And it was exactly the kind of service Lukaku wants. It was sort of to the side of the defender, and it meant that Lukaku could kind of roll him, and then he got a shot off that unfortunately was just a bit too close to the keeper. But you sort of went, yes, that's the service he needs. So it's not just the attacking players, it's the kind of service that Lukaku's getting. But I did feel like that goal did give Lukaku, even against its Al Hilal and a Club World Cup semi-final, I did feel like his appetite for the game and his influence on the game increased after that moment. It's like he did have a bit more of a confidence boost. But that's not to say he did enough. There's still a lot more to come from him, and Chelsea will hope that he does that in Saturday's final. I think within the club, there's a sort of a bit of an acceptance that there's a lot of circumstances that have contributed to Lukaku being in the sort of condition he currently is in, the injury, COVID, that it's set him back, and he's now sort of got no time to get into the kind of shape that he wants to be in, to be the Lukaku that people forget at the start of the season, you know, after those first few games when he was just bullying defenders, everyone was declaring Chelsea's title favourites. So I still think, you know, those people writing Lukaku off, I understand the frustration, but it's far too early. But we may have to wait until next season to see the best from him.
Yeah, I agree, it's far too early. And I guess we'll find out, won't we, beginning with Saturday, how much of it is just he needed a goal and how much of it is down to the sort of deeper-seated issues that Chelsea have had with their attack in general. The big talking point, I thought, before the game was Kai Havertz playing. That's you can look at me that way if you want, but I thought that was the significant thing about Chelsea's lineup. First start in more than a month since Spurs when he broke his finger. Only his second start alongside Lukaku. I know it wasn't the front two, but since September. So they haven't had a lot of opportunities to build chemistry. What did you make of Havertz's performance?
Yeah, I mean, great minds, Liam, because I tweeted when the team came out, I went, first time they've started together since the Tottenham, well, I think I said over a month, but it was the Tottenham game where they actually looked good, didn't they, in that first half. And then, unfortunately, Havertz busted his finger, and then that started his unfortunate sort of absence from the side. But yeah, I liked, you know, again, a bit like Lukaku, you can't get carried away. You can't sort of say, oh yes, Kai Havertz, magnificent, and should now start every game. But I thought we got to see a bit more of what he can do. And I particularly liked the run. He suddenly showed sort of great pace down the left, and then it was the most delightful little chip. Okay, it was from a narrow angle, but it was beautifully over the keeper, and then it, of course, hit the post. He just went, yeah, that's what Chelsea have paid money for. So it's only one performance, and I'm sure Kai Havertz wants to play a lot more, and inevitably that means Chelsea should get more out of him as a result, because, you know, like I said, that was his first appearance for over a month. The problem is that if you play Havertz and Lukaku, then you've got a decision to make about the third, if it is the sort of traditional three, or 3-4-2-1, or however Tuchel wants to do it. And it's between Mason Mount and Hakim Ziyech. And of course, Ziyech is on a pretty good run of form at the moment, I think people generally accept. But are you really going to leave Mason Mount outside? So but these are the decisions Tuchel, from wherever he is, he's got to decide on for the final, for example, wherever he is right now. It's still a debate whether he'll even get out here in time. Yeah, it's a tough call to make on Saturday, but I'd like to see Havertz in the car again.
Yeah, you have to annoy someone, don't you? And I think
I do.
Well, we wouldn't be doing our jobs if we weren't doing that, of course.
That's right.
But yeah, I mean, my general impression with Havertz when I watch him play is even when he's not doing something super eye-catching like that run, which was a real sort of sit-up-in-your-chair moment, his movement is very clever. He's a very positionally smart player. He's got a good tactical understanding of where he should be relative to his teammates. And he seems to make life a bit easier for them and for Chelsea's attack generally, regardless of where he starts, whether he's a false nine or one of the players behind the nine. It doesn't always translate into goals or assists, but I think it does have some sort of net positive impact. The thing is, you can kind of make a similar argument for Mason Mount. And you can certainly say right now that Hakim Ziyech is probably the most informed Chelsea forward. You have to annoy someone. Someone is going to be disappointed, most likely two or three people. But Chelsea, so they've booked their place into the Club World Cup final. It will be Brazilian opposition again, as it was in Japan in 2012. This time it's Palmeiras, who beat Al Ahly, I think, pretty convincingly. I only saw highlights of that game, but it looked like they were pretty worthy winners. Do you know anything about them? Have you watched anything of them? The one thing that I know that I've been told to expect from them is that, you know, as is customary with the South American teams that reach this stage, they consider this their Champions League final. This is their biggest game of the season, one of the biggest games in their history, and they will approach it accordingly.
Oh, for sure. And I actually, lucky for them, I bumped into some Palmeiras fans at breakfast this morning. I think they were kind of horrified by the Englishman that was asking them questions about the final. But they were very upbeat, very kind of, yeah, this is ours, da da da. And I think there is a huge, huge difference between the hunger for this trophy. And I think it is being stressed in the Chelsea camp. No, you know, come on, this is important. So you've got a couple of key people around. You know, obviously Azpilicueta was on the bench in that final 10 years ago, but Petr Cech, the technical and performance advisor, he was, of course, in goal against Corinthians. So they'll be sort of hammering home to everyone, look, this is a golden opportunity to make history, because Chelsea have never won this competition before. But the impression I'm getting is that Palmeiras are here in vast numbers compared to Chelsea fans. So I'm expecting, again, for Chelsea to feel like the away team on Saturday. So that's another challenge they're going to have to overcome. I think Palmeiras fans are going to be very loud, very sort of behind their team, as they should be. And Chelsea have got to do their best to subdue them. I'm disappointed that the wonder kid, is it Endrick, his name?
Endrick,
15.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm disappointed that he's not here. He's too young. He probably couldn't get a visa or something because he's too young. But yeah.
The cliche is he's obviously got exams the next day or something.
Yeah, he's got some homework to do. But there's a lot of obviously chat about him at the moment and how he's the next wonder kid from Brazil, and already stupid money being talked about him in terms of how much he'll cost. But Yeah, I think Chelsea are facing a really, they have a really difficult task. In my opinion, and listeners may not like me to say this, but I'm considering, given the way Chelsea played the last two games as well, I think they're going to this as underdogs for the two reasons. You know, I think Palmeiras, the hunger for this, and Chelsea just don't look at it, you know, in terms of, you know, they're not playing at their best. The caveat would be, in recent weeks, apart from the Man City game, Chelsea have saved their best performances for the best teams or the biggest teams or the biggest games. You know, the three against Spurs and the Liverpool comeback. So, you know, that's a more optimistic way of looking at the game. But, you could also argue the other way around, that the expectation on the Palmeiras shoulders with all those fans there, that may actually sort of, will they be the ones that feel the pressure more? So, there, I've basically ended up by sitting on the fence after all.
I think you've covered your bases in case of any eventual outcome.
Yeah, yes.
That's the aim of any on the ground journalist, I think, ahead of a football match.
Could happen. Might not happen. There you go. You read one it here or heard it here first.
One last thing on Saturday's game. Any indication in Abu Dhabi, or you've obviously been around Chelsea a bit today, that Thomas Tuchel could make it out in time for the game? My impression when he tested positive ahead of the FA Cup match was that it was extremely unlikely, because I've never personally tested positive, but I know people who have, and they've been saying that, you know, you can get positive PCRs 10, 11 days after you first tested positive, which would obviously be far too late for him to make the final.
Yeah, good question. He's testing every day. It hasn't been ruled out, but it's very touch and go. And there's that kind of question mark of, well, what happens if he comes out here and tests positive and he has to isolate for 10 days? The team would fly home and the coaching staff, and he'd have to do his communication, result low, etc., on some dodgy hotel Wi-Fi, like we're doing this podcast. You just imagine him like during a game going, shouting and ranting and raving. But my instincts tell me, and to be honest, I'm going, what's the point now? You know, of course you'd rather have Tuchel here and on the sidelines. The press certainly would prefer to have Tuchel out here. No offence to his two assistants, but yeah, the press conferences aren't quite as dynamite as they would be with Tuchel. But, you know, what's the point in risking a worse situation, Tuchel not being around back home? So, yeah, I my instincts lead me to think that, he won't be here on Saturday. But the players really shouldn't need their coach to be out here anyway. They know the job, the task at hand, and they should go out and perform.
Well, our listeners might rather have Matt running his usual tight ship, but you can't always get what you want, can you? You know,
that's right. Yeah.
Just got to deal with this. Right. That's everything on the game. Next up, your questions.
This episode is supported by season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
So I'm going to give this one to you first, Simon. It is, in many ways, the most pressing question, particularly given how he's performed recently and how he performed in the Al Hilal game. Does Kepa get the nodding goal, or do you bring back the Africa Cup of Nations champion, Edouard Mendy?
Can I first, before I actually answer the question, can I just flag the fact that isn't it great that we actually have this question? Like that someone's even asked the question. You date it back a few months or even last season. It's like no chance. You wouldn't hear anyone go, oh, who would you play? It would be Edouard Mendy. For me, I'd play Kepa. I think two reasons. One, he's in great form. He kind of deserves it after. I mean, it'd be a bit harsh after his last two performances to say, yeah, thanks for getting us through in the FA Cup and the Club World Cup semi-final. Go take your seat on the bench. But secondly, I know Mendy saved a penalty for Senegal in the shootout in AFCON.
It wasn't a great penalty. It wasn't a brilliant penalty save. He was in the right place.
No, so, I mean, yeah, congratulations, Eddie. I mean, I was delighted for him. I tweeted to that effect, you know, Eddie's actually saved the penalty. That was, almost more significant than Senegal winning it for the first time. Obviously, I jest. But no, in all seriousness, you sort of think, well, look, Kepa is incredible at penalties. He has like a sixth sense. And if you're basically thinking of doing a Super Cup, and bring him on for the penalty shootout. Hopefully Chelsea don't need it and do it in normal time. But you just sort of think, why not just start the guy? Mendy will be resume his place as number one when Chelsea get back. But I'm leaning towards Kepa. What do you think, Liv?
I think it's really difficult. And I think actually, longer term, it's a difficult question. Because as we've discussed at length, it's impossible for Chelsea to have any sort of path out of the Kepa situation while he's a number two. But he's not performing now the way he was under Lampard. He's performing like a number one goalkeeper. He would be worthy of playing as a number one for most teams in Europe, and they wouldn't feel remotely insecure about it. He's not making mistakes. He's making good saves. His distribution's solid. It's only the fact that Mendy has been so solid and really barely put a foot wrong since he came into Chelsea that makes this such a difficult question. I think it's a big question for Chelsea long term, because I think there will definitely be people at the club who would like to see Kepa reinstated as number one goalkeeper at some point, because that's the way this £71 million transfer is not forever regarded as a disaster. But at the same time, Mendy has a lot of credit in the bank, doesn't he? You know, Petr Cech, Christophe Lolochon put their necks out to sign him initially, and he's validated their faith emphatically. Best keeper in the world last year, according to some. I don't know. I think I would play Mendy from the start, because that's the current hierarchy, and then do what you did in the Super Cup and bring Kepa on for the shootout. You have five substitutes. And while I was impressed less by Mendy's save and more by his more apparent gamesmanship in that Africa Cup of Nations shootout, he was doing a lot more of the Kepa stuff of like pointedly handing the ball to the taker, you know, is that ball on the spot? You know, bouncing around on his line, trying to be as distracting as possible. I need to ask a few more questions about this, but I'd love to know if Chelsea actually have drills where their goalkeepers practice being as annoying as possible from penalties.
Because Kepa's
brilliant at it, and he really embraces his role as the villain in those shootouts, and I think it makes him better as a saver. Mendy, I think when he came in, was too nice. And he was too quiet, and he'd just kind of get ready for the kick and then politely dive the other way. He seems to be making progress, but I'd still favour Kepa in those situations. So Mendy from the start, Kepa for any sort of shootout, but Chelsea shouldn't need it. Right. Okay. The next question. I'll start on the next one and then I'll throw it over to you. We've discussed it a bit already. Obviously, Lukaku is the biggest talking point at Chelsea right now. Andrew Turner is not happy with Lukaku. I know this. And his question is essentially, is he untouchable at the club, given that he's started 9 games in a row? There seems to be a concerted effort on the part of Tuchel and maybe the people above him at the club to give Lukaku every chance, particularly in the sort of wake of that interview. And thus far, it hasn't, you know, yielded the kind of results that anyone would have hoped for. So is he untouchable? I don't think so, but I do think it's a case of Tuchel being aware and genuinely wanting to make Lukaku work. I think he's aware that if Lukaku doesn't work in the long term, it won't just reflect badly on Lukaku. I think it will reflect badly on him as well with the club. It will be one of the things that he's ultimately judged on. And if Chelsea keep competing for trophies, if they keep reaching the final of every competition they're in under Tuchel, which is what they've done so far, and winning a fair few of them, then Tuchel will be fine even if Lukaku's underperforming. But if Lukaku's underperforming and that becomes part of the broader tapestry of Chelsea's struggle, then that will become a massive, stick to beat him with. Might be a bit harsh, but it certainly will be a focus of criticism and questioning, I think, internally as well as externally. So Tuchel is invested in making Lukaku work at Chelsea. Obviously, the people above him want Lukaku to work. He's the most expensive player Chelsea have ever signed. So I think that's more down to the run they're giving him now. Arne Mikkels alluded to that after the FA Cup game as well, saying, look, we have to show faith in him in difficult moments. Chelsea have been here before with Fernando Torres, Alvaro Morata, Andrei Shevchenko. These guys get every chance because there's too much invested in them to just discard them so quickly. But what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, like you, you know, very aware of Andrew's he's not content with Lukaku. And yeah, totally understandable why Chelsea fans, readers have been disappointed with how the season's gone. But as I said earlier, you know, Lukaku has been unfortunate given the kind of player physique he has. He needs to be training. And the ankle injury, COVID, all of that just completely threw him off. And the only way that he can get back to the shape that he was, I don't think anyone can deny that Lukaku looked very good at the start of the season. And he actually looked very good against Aston Villa when he came off the bench. He looked pretty good against Brighton the next game. Then the interview came out. But yeah, the only way that we can get back to that Lukaku is if he plays. You know, he's got to sort of get back into that sort of physical fitness. You know, he's clearly fit, but it's a big jump between fit and match fitness, match sharpness. And I think that's one of the issues. It's not the only issue, as you touched on earlier. And then there's also if you spend £97.5 million, you don't put him on the bench. You know, he's got to play. Simple as that. The argument, of course, that Andrew will certainly raise, and understandably so, is Kai Havertz is hardly cheap. And he's been on the bench. And you could argue that Chelsea played their best football this season when Havertz was leading the line. But Lukaku, he's the main man. You know, he's the most handsomely played player and he's the most expensive signing in the club's history. So he's got to play. It's as simple as that.
I'm going to blend the next two questions because they're kind of similar. They're both referring to a back four, essentially. Soham asks, do you think it's good to switch to a back four till Reece James and or Chile return? This might unlock Ziyech and Havertz/Callum Hudson-Odoi in wide positions like we observed with this system. I'm presuming he's referring mainly to the Tottenham games in the League Cup.
Yeah, I think I have liked it, but I think it's very much a game-per-game basis. I think it depends a lot on the opposition because Chelsea naturally in that system are a little bit more open, a little bit more easy to get at. But I do like it. It does sort of allow an extra attacking player to be on the pitch. And when you don't have Reece James and Ben Chilwell, as good as solid pros, and as you know, they'll put in all the effort in the world. The Spanish Giro, as per the quote from Alonso, they can't replicate the energy that James and Chilwell play. There's no coincidence that Chelsea's sort of loss of their title challenge is coincided with those two being outside. They were flying back in November because James was out. His injury came in December. But yeah, it started with Chilwell. Then they lost James. And, you know, those two are the equivalent of Andy Robertson and Trent Alexander-Arnold, you know. And, you know, imagine Liverpool without those two for a considerable amount of time. Yes, they've got reasonable backup, but they are backup for a reason. So, yeah, I like the system, but it's very much a game per game, depending on the opposition basis. It certainly looked good against Spurs.
Yeah, I agree. I like the 4-2 Desmond. Gets more attackers onto the pitch. It gets more attackers, in particular, closer to Lukaku. And I think we saw that in both games against Spurs, that there were promising signs. Yeah. But it has to be, you know, kind of within the context of who you're facing. You know, Tuchel can't be wedded to any one system. I think he has to react a little bit to the circumstances.
Just quickly, I'd also be happier if Conte was Conte as one of the two, if you get my drift. Like if he's at his normal standard, then I'm much happier, because obviously he can cover, as is often joked about, you know, he's like two players. So then suddenly you're not as defensively vulnerable because he can cover so much ground. But at the moment, he doesn't look, as I said earlier, he doesn't like quite look his normal self, but I'm sure it's just a temporary thing.
Sean asks, what's wrong with our slow, lethargic attacking play? Are we just tired, or is there a deeper problem? I think it's a little from column A, a little from column B. They're lethargic at the moment. I think there's a certain amount of physical fatigue, a certain amount of mental fatigue as well, from so many games, even with the break they've had recently. And I think as the intensity of the team has dropped off, that's affected all parts of Chelsea's game, including the attack. But what we've seen under Tuchel is this is a broader issue. I think the attacking system can be a bit too rigid at times. It seems to be, you know, very focused on getting the wing-backs opportunities with lots of positional changes, and that might not always lend itself to having the most ruthless attack, even if you are sort of unconventionally asking questions of teams. But it does feel like a lot of Chelsea's forwards are not quite as free as they would like to be to make decisions within the system. And that also means when they do make decisions, they tend to get them wrong. We see an awful lot of passes behind a man, overhit, played when a teammate's on his heels rather than running onto the ball. Chelsea find really creative ways to screw up promising situations. And that was actually also, I think, a bit of a theme under Lampard as well. So I think that there's certainly some reflection on this group of players, as much as it's changed over the last 18 months. I think some of the attackers are young, and maybe their decision-making isn't as good as it will end up being. The collective chemistry isn't there. Maybe Tuchel's rotation is a part of that. But I don't just think it's a physical or mental fatigue issue. I think there's a broader tactical thing at play, and maybe a man management thing at play as well.
Yeah, I just quickly to my tap and some, I'd say never rule out the significance of confidence. You know, they are human, and you know, I think you've seen players lacking confidence, but for many reasons, there's been an awful lot of chopping and changing. You could attribute that to Tuchel not knowing what his best team is, injuries, COVID, so many factors. So is it any wonder that there's no real understanding, because these guys really haven't had the chance to develop one? Because every week, the team changes for one reason or another. You don't tend to see the same guys playing every week together up top. So yes, you sort of suddenly got a run of Lukaku starts. And Ziyech has played quite a bit recently. But as we discussed earlier, last night it was Kai Havertz that played. You know, before it might have been Mason Mount or a Pulisic or a Hudson-Odoi. You know, so it's the chopping and changing that hasn't helped either. But that's not just down to Tuchel, that's down to other circumstances.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner StubHub has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
There'll be no quiz this week, and rest assured that's not because we all secretly hate the quiz and they only ever happen because Matt forces them upon us. It just wouldn't feel right to do it without Matt here to torture us in the good-natured way that he generally does every week. So we're going to skip that.
Can I just say, and I just want to bask in my victory for one more week, you know, my only victory so far. So I just want to keep the winning streak going as long as possible, even though it's only just one. Yeah, carry on.
I'm not sure I've ever won one. Anyway, yeah, so we'll just quickly round up the youth team and the women's team. The under-19s crashed out of the youth league after a 5-1 defeat in their playoff game against Genk. They were second in their group, and Genk had qualified from the domestic champions path, and it was a rough afternoon for Andy Meyer's team. There was no game for the under-23s this weekend. The under-18s play their Premier League Cup quarterfinal against Manchester United at Cobham. That's an 11 a.m. kickoff on Saturday. And the women's team have a huge game against Arsenal on Friday night. It's another sellout at King's Meadow. And if Chelsea win, they'll go top and be a point ahead of Arsenal with a game in hand. After Friday, Chelsea have just 5 matches of the season to go. 4 of them are against teams currently in the bottom half of the table. So if they win against Arsenal, they're in a fantastic position to close this out. Here's what they had to say about the game on the Athletic Women's Football Podcast.
There is a huge, massive game coming up at Chelsea against Arsenal on Friday night. Arsenal won the reverse fixture, if you take your mind all the way back to the opening day of the season at the Emirates. 3-2 the score on that day, but it was a long time ago now. What will be the key here for both teams on Friday, Laura? Remembering that Chelsea didn't start with Kerr and Kirby. We haven't seen much of Kirby in the last few matches either. She's come on as a sub. Is there going to be a factor there that will come into play if they start together?
Yeah, potentially. I mean, it's brilliant, isn't it? From a fan's point of view, it's brilliant when they do play together. I think one of the key things for Chelsea is that they have to keep performing defensively like they have been, you know, that especially that solid back five, with including Berger. I think, you know, how we've seen Harder come and operate on that left-hand side and be so dominant and overload. And then when she picks up the ball, you know, she's shown her worth and her quality against Manchester United, against Man City especially. So she needs to keep doing that. And then also, I think in their high press, I think they've been, like, you know, they have been very good out of possession. I think someone who is key to that is Erin Cuthbert, we know about. It'll be interesting to see whether she plays centre mid. Mm-hmm. But I think she's allowed to do that because I do believe that Jessie Fleming, out of possession, she works so hard. She can cover two, she can cut off the deny space and press the player on the ball. You know, she's so key. Her energy and her work rate and her game intelligence is really key. So she'll be important, I think, for Chelsea. But as for Arsenal, I think it is unleash Miedemar and Blackstenius, because as much as, you know, you can prepare all week, Chelsea can maybe prepare for those two playing, actually not having the experience and not having much video footage, it could be the surprise that and the impetus that Arsenal need.
You can hear the Women's Football Podcast every week ad-free on The Athletic or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for putting up with this clearly makeshift podcast with a absolutely obviously substandard host. But I was getting worried for a minute. I've been Liam Toomey. Thanks to Simon Johnson in Abu Dhabi. And we'll see you on Monday, hopefully with Matt, to reflect on the men's and the women's teams matches.
The Athletic.